Thank you, Pastor Stephen. Most of us know about the Titanic, but I doubt if many of us have heard about the sinking of the RMS Taylor. In your bulletin, you should have a handout which will help you follow along today. Speaking about the Taylor, it was a fully rigged iron clipper ship that set sail on her maiden voyage in 1854, and it has actually been described as the first Titanic. Now, we know that the Titanic sank because she did not pay attention to the icebergs in the area. But the Taylor sank because the shipbuilders did something really dumb. They did not anticipate that the ship's iron hull would discombobulate the compasses. And so 48 hours after leaving port, the Taylor ran into a fog and then into a storm. When the crew thought that they were sailing into the Irish Sea, they actually were headed west, and the ship ran right into an island. Of the 650 people on board, 370 people perished. The heart is like a compass, and that's why the writer in Proverbs tells us to keep it with all diligence. And so today we want to talk about the human heart. And I want to do this in relation to being made in the likeness of Christ, or what some people call Christian formation. We could even call it sanctification. The problem is that our heart occasionally gets discombobulated. We often think that we know where we're going, but in truth, our heart is adrift and restless. This is why the Bible sometimes describes sanctification as a proactive matter. And for purposes of today, we can say that our sanctification really consists of two things that we find in Titus chapter 2. Our sanctification involves first renouncing and then reorienting. So if you look at Titus chapter 2 and verse 11, it says, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age." And so there are two actions here for our sanctification. First, renouncing, and then reorienting. We have to do this as Christian people because our hearts are prone to wander. Augustine of Hippo, who you see quoted there in your handout, said, "You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." Now, this is true for salvation, but it is also true for sanctification. From Augustine's prayer, we immediately see several things. First, we see that human beings are made by and for the Creator. "You have made us for yourself." But also something in this prayer, to be human is to be for something. that is for a vision of a perceived good. Finally, we see that the heart is just as important as the head. That is to say, the pull of a vision toward a perceived good is not primarily a pull of the intellect. It's primarily a pull of the heart. The great theologian Bob, you may like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls. But you're going to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're going to have to serve somebody. Think of it like this. A guy goes to a marriage counselor and he says, "I want a divorce from my wife." And the counselor says, "Why do you want to divorce your wife?" And the man says, "Well, I don't love her anymore." And the counselor says, "Well, who do you love?" You see, you're going to love somebody. You're going to serve somebody. Augustine knew, and many Christians have known throughout all the ages, that the way you grow as a Christian is by properly calibrating the heart, which is like a compass. And so, this is what we want to talk about right now. I want to first discuss how the heart becomes set on something in the first place, and then I want to consider how we can properly calibrate our heart toward Christ. An excellent resource for today's message is James K. Smith's book, You Are What You Love, to which the title of this sermon has been taken. And I will reference Smith. But let's first consider how the heart becomes calibrated in the first place. Augustine and Dylan are saying it's not a question of whether you love something, because we all love something. You cannot not love. The more difficult question is, who or what do you love? You see, God made us for Himself, and our hearts are restless until it finds rest in Him. All people have this longing, and it's sort of built in right here in the heart. The problem is that sin has warped this longing. So we spend a great deal of our time to try to fill this vacuum. And in doing so, in our pursuits, we are looking for some vision of the good, some version of the kingdom. So here's a question for you. What version of the kingdom are you looking for? And how you answer this question is very important, because people live for what they love. They get up in the morning and they do their thing day after day, and this forms them. Our loves are formed by what we think and do, our habits. The ancients said that good moral habits constitute virtues, and bad moral habits constitute vices. So from a Christian perspective, virtue is what we mean when we talk about godliness. Likewise, vice is what we mean when we talk about ungodliness. Virtues are dispositions toward the good. Good moral habits practiced over time form our character, and they make us inclined to be Things like compassionate, or forgiving, or kind. This is why the Bible says, train up a child in the way that he should go. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. And anyone who has children should understand this truth. We make our children behave when they're young, right? So they will grow up and hopefully behave when they become adults. We make them say thank you and please, because we want them to grow up and say these things. We try to instill good habits in their lives. We make them brush their teeth because we want them to grow up and brush their teeth. We make them do chores around the house because we want them to appreciate the value of work as adults. So moral habits, practiced over time, become second nature to us. Virtue becomes ingrained into us through habit so that our thinking and behavior toward the good becomes sort of natural, sort of second place, like blinking or breathing. And a person does not acquire virtue by simply knowing about virtue or thinking about virtue, however important that might be. Just as important, however, is this truth. Virtue is acquired through two means. First, imitation. And second, practice. The children pick up the good habits of their parents by seeing good behavior modeled. This is also true for grown-up Christian people as well. The scriptures bear this out. Jesus said, "For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you." Paul said to the Christians at Corinth, "Be imitators of me as I am of Christ." Again, Paul tells the Christians at Philippi, he says, "Brothers, join in imitating me and keep your eyes on those who walk according to the example you have in us." So the principle of imitation is in the Bible. Not only is virtue acquired through imitation, it's also acquired through practice. Good moral habits come to us by repeating them over and over, day in and day out. And so it's through the rituals and the rhythms of our lives that godliness is acquired. We're talking about sanctification here. We're talking about Christian formation in the life of a believer. We could also say that our daily rituals have the potential of doing the inverse. That is, to reinforce vice. This is why daily routines are extremely important. Now, Smith refers to these daily routines as cultural rituals. For example, the American affection for shopping is a kind of cultural liturgy that holds out the good of consumerism. Smith says that the mall is kind of like a temple that we visit on a regular basis, ritually, and it shapes our hearts toward consumption. Likewise, we could say that the time that we spend in front of television, a television screen, is a kind of cultural liturgy that holds out the good of entertainment. The hours we spend, say, watching professionalized sports is a kind of cultural liturgy that holds out the good of spectatorship. The time teenagers and preteens spend with their cell phones, taking it to bed with them, is a habit of the heart that constitutes a kind of cultural liturgy. Relentless hours of playing video games can become a cultural liturgy. Facebook time can become a cultural liturgy in its own right. We could even say that the time a person spends pursuing the high and the almighty dollar, like there's no tomorrow, constitutes a cultural liturgy. That is, doing all you can, canning all you do, and sitting on the can. Now, of course, our pursuits, these kinds of things, are not necessarily bad within themselves. But they shape us. They shape us in ways that we don't realize. They do so because they take up our time, and they take up our attention. We also pour our affections into these rituals. But here's what you need to understand. People who design cell phones, people who build malls and produce football programming, they really don't care about what you think. But they do care very much about what you love. And we're saturated in these liturgies every day. People at Apple don't want you to just use your cell phone. They want you to love it. Smith says, all kinds of cultural rhythms and routines are, in fact, rituals that function as pedagogies of desire. Precisely because they tactically and covertly train us to love a certain version of the kingdom, teaching us to long for some rendition of the good life. He says these are not just things that we do, but they do something to us. And so what we have to do is recalibrate the heart. In Titus chapter 2, it teaches us that recalibrating the heart first requires us to denounce or to renounce. To deny ungodliness and worldly passions. In the same way, Paul says in Ephesians that the way of Christ teaches us to put off the old self and put on the new self. In Ephesians 4, 20-24. So sanctification is a two-way process. First, we renounce, and then we reorient. That means we have to add something to what we have done in our lives. We renounce ungodliness and we put on godliness. That's sanctification. And one of the most important ways that we recalibrate our hearts is through worship. Proper Christian worship counterbalances the rival liturgies that surround us and covertly capture our loves. So the practice of praying and singing and listening to the sermon and participating at the Lord's table reorients our affections and puts Christ before our very eyes every Sunday. So church is where we hear about those rival kingdoms that will have their end. For example, the point of apocalyptic literature is not just prediction, but the unveiling of realities for what they really are. In the book of Revelation, we find these words: "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, for all the nations have drunk the wine and the passion of her sexual immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed immorality with her, and the merchants of the earth have grown rich from the power of her luxurious living." And so when we hear such things like that on Sunday, we are reminded that the best devised cultural liturgies that don't factor in God will come to nothing. We also must be readers of cultural liturgies. And what I'm trying to do in the Sunday School series is help us to see, help us to read the patterns, the ebbs and the flow of life that really has an effect on our relationship with Christ. As we have said in the lessons, I like to call this kind of cultural awareness totoism. Totoism, a kind of pulling back of the curtain, like Dorothy's dog in The Wizard of Oz, to reveal the man in the machine. And so Smith says that we constantly need to be asking ourselves these kinds of questions as Christians. What are the secular liturgies in our lives? What version of the good life is carried in those liturgies? What story is embedded in these cultural practices? What kind of person do they want me to become? To what kingdom are these rituals aimed? Unfortunately, behind the values of modern worship is the assumption that forms are neutral. That it doesn't really matter what kind of music that you use or what kind of prayers that you say, even what you do, just so long as some essence of the Christian message gets through. But forms are not neutral. By form, we're talking about the overarching aspect of our worship, the specific practices that we do on Sunday morning. Fortunately, the church has been worshiping for a very long time. And while all worship is liturgical, some liturgical practices are actually better than others, especially if they enjoin our hearts and minds and bodies to glorify the triune God. On your handout, I would like to give you 6 important principles about Christian worship that I've sort of gleaned from Smith. And the first one is this: the Christian faith is caught as much as it is taught. The Christian faith is caught as much as it is taught. You see, when done properly, Christian worship implants the biblical story of redemption into our very bones. And it does this on a weekly basis. Second, when done properly, Christian worship does not just target the intellect, but also the whole person. When done properly, Christian worship does not just target the intellect, but the whole person. And so our singing and our praying and our listening to the sermon, the sacraments of baptism and the Lord's table, The entire liturgy appeals to multiple senses. The ear gate and the eye gate and the nose gate and the taste gate and the touch gate. Worship, therefore, is incarnational, affecting both head and heart, both soul and body. Soul and body, which are not separate entities, but they're enmeshed. Next, Christian worship provides a corrective to the secular liturgies that surround us, which often unconsciously captures our hearts. Christian worship provides a corrective to the secular liturgies that surround us, which often unconsciously captures our hearts. So worship liturgies are really tools of remembrance, just like the stones that God wanted the people to place in the middle of the Jordan River when they crossed through it. Worship recalibrates us to the divine narrative and reminds us that God's redemptive story, and not only that, but our place in God's story. Next, Christian worship gives us a vision of the beauty of Christ. Christian worship gives us a vision of the beauty of Christ. Remember, as human beings, we're made for vision. We are aesthetic-oriented creatures who are moved by appeals not only to the heart, pathos, but also we're moved by appeals to the head, logos. We're motivated by what captures that vision. Therefore, the imagination also becomes important. Therefore, preaching should make use of story and metaphor and well-crafted prose. And doing all this, casting a vision of the beauty of Christ. As the psalmist said, "One thing have I asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." Next, Christian worship is communal. Christian worship is communal. On Sunday, we come before God together, not just as individuals. We gather together. We confess together. We listen together. We respond together. We commune at the table together. We are sent out to serve together. And then finally, Christian worship utilizes both variety and repetition. Christian worship utilizes both variety and repetition. Both variety and repetition are infused in calling, confessing, consecrating, communing, and commissioning. So hymns and psalms and prayers and sermons and words of institution, they may vary. And yet there is a rhythm, there is a pattern of worship that is deliberately repetitious. And this is intentional, because worship is a habit of the heart that forms our Christian posture toward God. You know, we often think that whatever is repetitious is also monotonous. G.K. Chesterton reminds us that this is not always the case, that some of the best things in life are repetitious, especially if they're good things. And children know this instinctively. Chesterton says in Orthodoxy. He says, because children have abounding vitality, because they are in spirit fierce and free, they want things to be repeated and unchanged. They always say, do it again. And a grown-up person does it again until they're nearly dead. For grown-up people, Chesterton says, are not strong enough to rejoice in repetition. But perhaps God is strong enough to rejoice in repetition. It's possible, he says, that every morning God says, do it again to the sun. And every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately. But God has never gotten tired of making them, Chesterton says. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. And so the local church is a vital place for Christian formation to take place. But the Christian home is also a place for the formation of the heart. And while we may only spend several hours a week at church, we actually spend many more hours at home. Too often, the modern home has become little more than an entertainment hub and a temporary sleeping quarters for frustrated children and self-actualizing adults. The rhythms and the rituals that occur in the home shape the child in a permanent way. The knot formed in childhood is very difficult to unravel once they reach adulthood. There must be a reason that Jesus said, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone tied around his neck and for him to be thrown in the depths of the sea. And so discipleship begins at home. And so the most important liturgies begin at home. As the Shema says in Deuteronomy, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words I command you shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them while you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. And so as we're wrapping this up today in your handout, I would like to give you some important household liturgies. There's the garage liturgy. The garage liturgy. Here, Father and Son work together with greasy hands to make new objects and repair old ones. Stories are being told in the garage, stories that place the boy in a larger story, that gives him some idea where he came from, what's expected of him, and where they are headed in God's great big story. There's the kitchen liturgy. Here, mother and daughter have flour up to their elbows, creating tonight's dinner or tomorrow's church potluck. And narratives are being shared. narratives that place the girl in a larger narrative, narratives that give some idea of where she came from and what's expected of her and where they're headed in God's great big story. Of course, I don't mean to exclude men from the kitchen or women from the garage, for that matter. What part of the house that we find ourselves in comes to us naturally, according to our own inclinations. There's the dining room liturgy. Here the entire family is gathered around the table. No one is listening to music through an earpiece. No one's looking at a screen. Listen, you can hear it. You can hear them. Bless us, O Lord, in these gifts which we are about to receive from your bounty. Then the food is passed, and the day's events are rehearsed. Encouragement is dispensed. Questions are asked. Sally wants to know when she can bake her own pie. Johnny wants to know why there's evil in the world. Little Ruby wants to know who lives on the moon. All the questions are discussed, and no one has to be anywhere in the next hour. And kids love dinner even more when there are guests around the table. There is the living room liturgy. Here, family devotionals are had before bedtime. Scripture reading or catechism or singing or prayer takes place, usually no more than 15 or 20 minutes. During the year, the Christian calendar is honored in a tangible way, whether one is wrapping a Christmas present or painting an Easter egg. Candles and symbols and music and art and drama flourish in the living room because, you see, it's an imagination station for the kingdom of God. There's the bedroom liturgy. The imagination also flourishes in the bedroom. So books like the Chronicles of Narnia come to life. Sally is deep into sense and sensibility. Johnny is hearing The Hobbit read for the first time. Ruby lights up as she is absorbed in the colorful pages of Goodnight Moon. There's the backyard liturgy. In the backyard, Dad mows the grass and Mom snips the shrubs and Sally paints the patio furniture. Johnny feeds the dog and Ruby holds a funeral service for George, the dead grasshopper. There's even a family garden in the backyard, which everyone tends. Good gifts come from the family garden. So our subject today has been one of Christian formation, which is a matter of keeping the heart fixed on Christ and his kingdom. Our sanctification is not passive. It's active. And it requires us to recalibrate the heart constantly. Keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life. You know, the world has its own liturgies. And the church and the Christian home, they need to have their liturgies too. These Christ-forming liturgies act as pacemakers for our defective hearts. They set the beat aright and they tune us toward God's heart. Please pray with me.